On April 15th, 2024, the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump, the criminal trial of the 45th and 47th president of the United States, began in a Manhattan courtroom. It would prove to be one of the most consequential criminal trials in American history and the start of a new era in politics and American jurisprudence. The trial ended with the first ever criminal conviction of a United States president. While cameras were banned from the proceedings, the rare modern event not captured on camera, New York Times journalist Jonah Bromwich was there reporting on all the crucial details from the media circus outside of 100 Center Street to the tense courtroom inside and every frenzied location in between. And now with Donald Trump back in the White House and Judge Juan Merchan's sentencing complete, Bromwich delivers, with new reporting, a definitive account of the stranger-than-fiction showdown in his new book, Dragon on Center Street, New York versus Donald J. Trump. It is published by Authors Equity, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jonah Bromwich to the roundtable this morning. Jonah, thank you very much for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
When you first started to cover this case, I just, like, thinking about it, of before you even went into the courtroom, it's just an odd situation all the way around, isn't it?
I mean, it's a remarkably odd situation. I started covering New York City courts in 2021, and it is remarkable how much of my time has been spent following, reporting on, trying to break news on investigations into Donald Trump. And I think it really shows you just how much attention there was on him from law enforcement authorities at that time.
When you went in and once you ultimately are there and watching, as we should note, the cameras were banned from the proceedings, and this is not captured on camera, which is now very, very rare. The onus then comes on you and other journalists to report on all the details of what is happening in that courtroom. What struck you about that?
I mean, this was an extraordinary thing to bear witness to. You had Donald Trump, who was then not in office, but still one of the most powerful politicians in America, coming into a courtroom every day and not talking and not holding attention, but sitting quietly, almost passively, as people from his former life, his allies and his adversaries alike, came in and were questioned by the prosecution about this story. And the story is not just, as is often thought or assumed, a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, but really three separate payments that the prosecutors in this criminal case argued effectively corrupted the 2016 election, the only election that at that point, the point that the trial was taking place, Trump had ever won. So to see Donald Trump in this atmosphere in New York State court, out of his element in almost every way possible, it was just an extraordinary thing. And that's what I really describe in the book, which is called Dragon on Center Street.
It is fascinating when you look at it, because Trump not being in his element means he's not able to speak. He's not in control. He is not wielding the power that he usually wields. And it's also very different than most of his other criminal cases, which is a pretty lengthy list.
Yeah, no, 100%. Though this is the only criminal case against Donald Trump that went to trial. And so it's a very confusing thing, I think, because Donald Trump was, first of all, under so much scrutiny, both from prosecutors, so that is criminal scrutiny, and also from law enforcement officials who might bring lawsuits against him, so that's civil scrutiny. He went to three civil trials right before this criminal case. And the big difference between a civil trial and a criminal trial is that in a civil trial, you can be held liable and you can be assessed a penalty. And that's exactly what happened to Donald Trump. But in a criminal case, you can be found guilty and you can be sent to prison. And so the stakes of this criminal trial that I write about in the book were significantly higher for him than in any other trial he'd ever faced.
So bring us into the courtroom of Judge Juan Merchan. This is a fascinating figure and someone who you watched and you watched at work. And give us a sense of that courtroom and how he was in charge, of what he was able to do to ensure that this is a case that runs as smoothly as possible.
Sure. So 100 Center Street, which is the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse, is this grand Art Deco building, and it's got high ceilings. It's got these kind of beautiful light fixtures, and it would all be this kind of remarkable picture of justice in action. Were it not for the fact that everything is very decrepit, everything is very dirty. The courtroom is incredibly grimy. So you have Trump, the former president of the United States and the future president of the United States, coming into this environment that is unglamorous, that is in many ways kind of below what many people might think his station would be. And this courtroom is presided over by a former prosecutor, a judge named Juan Merchan. And Merchan has this reputation in state court, which can be a little loose, it can be a little wild, of being really authoritative and really having a lot of control over the courtroom. And one of the things that we saw during this trial that was really astonishing to witness is that outside of the courtroom, Trump would attack Merchan as corrupt and say he was biased against him and he couldn't possibly hold a fair trial. But inside the courtroom, where Merchan had all this power, Trump was almost meek. I mean, he really was silenced to an extent that is just very rare to see the current president be silenced.
So with that said, of seeing him in this meek state, did that have an impact on how the day-to-day operations of the trial ran?
Yes, it allowed the trial to function as a trial, which is to say the witnesses came in, they testified, the prosecutors were able to unspool their story in a way that I think made sense to the jury, and the jury was really locked into that story, paying close attention to this remarkable tale that retold the political history of 2015 and 2016 with all these details about stories that the prosecutors alleged and eventually proved that Trump had covered up. So one of the points that I make in the book is that Trump is very dominant in the 21st century because he really has incredible commands of our media apparatuses. On social media, on television, those are Trump's natural media. He really thrives in them. And the courtroom is really a throwback. Cameras weren't allowed in it. Cell phones, the jurors aren't, you know, flipping through their cell phones as they have to pay attention to testimony. So you have this old-fashioned attention atmosphere where a case for persuasion, a kind of long, involved criminal case, can go off and can be persuasive to a group of people.
One of the things I remember and I think of as doing a talk show every morning about issues of the day, that every once in a while when we talk about this case and others, that you sort of have to remember which one. I mean, there were so many cases going on in different and different criminal activity that you're like, oh, okay, this is the one for falsifying business records in order to conceal hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. And so there is watching this trial, but also I assume for you, kind of keeping an eye on what else was going on in the legal, in Trump's legal world.
Yeah, of course. This was one of the most difficult tasks for me and the other reporters who covered Donald Trump, and specifically the legal investigations into him, was that it was difficult for normal people, even people who follow the news closely, who care about current events, to keep these things straight. Not because those people were ignoramuses, but because it was genuinely complicated given all the legal trouble that Trump was in. And I thought that really rebounded to the former president at that time's advantage. It was hard to keep track of these things. People couldn't necessarily parse the details or didn't have time to parse the details. And so it was all a confusing blur. And then when Trump would make arguments about lawfare, about one big witch hunt against him, I think that for a certain segment of the population, those arguments made sense, especially given that it was so difficult to tell these cases apart.
Jonah Bromwich is the author of the new book, Dragon on Center Street, New York versus Donald J. Trump. There was what was going on inside the courtroom, and then, of course, what was going on outside the courtroom. And not surprisingly, it was a circus, an absolute circus, as you would expect it to be when a president of the United States, a former president, is on trial. For you, how much did that leak through and an awareness of what was going on outside while you were inside?
My book is really set in New York City. It's a book about New York City. And I was very aware even as I was covering the trial, even as I was in the courtroom for 7 hours a day or however long it was, of what was happening outside, because what was happening outside was constantly being brought to our attention. So, for example, in the book, I tell the story of Max Azzarello, who is a man who tragically killed himself outside the courthouse right toward the end of jury selection. His story is fascinating. This book is the first time it's really been told in full. And one of the things that I learned about Max was that he had a conspiracy theory that he was very eager for the world to hear. And he understood that because Trump was on trial, because all the cameras were outside 100 Center Street, if he wanted to get that story out, that was the place to do it. And so people like him, people with even less dramatic stories, were kind of sucked into this maelstrom of news, energy, and chaos that the trial created. And that wasn't just within the courthouse, that was also outside. One other thing to say on this point, which is that about halfway through the trial, Trump's allies, Republican allies from Congress and elsewhere, started coming to court. Right. And they also transformed the energy, because it was not just what was happening inside the trial. It was the way they were speaking to cameras outside of the trial, telling Trump's story on his behalf, attacking prosecutors in a way that he couldn't do, attacking witnesses in a way he couldn't do. And so, to your point, Joe, it was an absolute circus, and really fascinating to see that contrast between what was going on inside with the kind of steady attention I described earlier with what was going on outside with this constant news and fervor and chaos.
Reading about Max Azzarello was fascinating. I mean, you talk about how that cast a pall on the trial, and I certainly imagine that it would. Let us talk for a moment about Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. This is a man who remains elusive and is a bit of an enigma, and I'm curious as to what you witnessed of how he does his job and what he saw his job to be and how he executed it.
Yeah, it's a great question, and your description of Alvin Bragg is spot on. I covered him starting when he ran for Manhattan District Attorney, so I had really a front row seat, not just to this trial that ended up being the defining trial of his career, but also all the lead up to it. And I think what's important to understand about Alvin Bragg is that he came up at a time when what's often called progressive prosecution was in vogue, where prosecutors around the country were running on the idea that prosecutors were overly aggressive, were racist, were treating defendants who had committed very mild crimes way too harshly, and conversely, we're not treating serious crimes harshly enough. So Alvin Bragg comes up during that time, finds success during that time under a philosophy that had really never been seen by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And then amidst all this kind of excitement over reform and skepticism over reform in large part, he also inherits the Trump case. And so I think what he did with the Trump case, which was not simply to prosecute the first case that came to him, but was actually to reject a case that had been built by his predecessor and say, I don't like this case, we're not going to indict Trump on this, but then go ahead and build his own different case, really shows you, I think, one of the extraordinary challenges posed to prosecutors who are in this situation, who are trying to figure out, how do I deal with the possibility that the former president and this remarkably powerful person broke the law?
When it comes to jury selection, it's monotonous, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And yet, it could be argued, it worked.
Jury selection is fascinating to me as a reporter, although I think undeniably monotonous to watch. It's not a great spectator sport, so to speak, because it's repetitive. Jurors answer kind of in monosyllables questions about their life. But ultimately, what happens is prosecutors and defense lawyers interview civilians to try and create a panel that could be favorable to them, that could help them. And one of the things that was fascinating about this jury selection, of course, was that Donald Trump was in the room. So you had jurors being asked about their opinions of Donald Trump, and who, after they kind of got inured to his presence and started to feel used to him in the courtroom, started to speak very frankly about what they thought about Donald Trump, which, as you might imagine, in Manhattan was not always very positive. So you had people calling him kind of, I think he lies, I think he's self-involved. Some people were more complimentary. You had a few Art of the Deal readers who said they had liked the book, which Trump very clearly liked. We saw him nod in approval during jury selection when someone said they had read his book. But really amazing to see this jury get selected in front of the former president with the stakes basically as high as they could be.
You talk about the Trump attention economy, and here is a trial that at some points has you reporting live from the courtroom for almost a month, and which is, I assume, not something you're used to, and yet is really because of, again, cameras not being in the courtroom, that something that we rely on for information about this very important trial.
Yeah, it's very interesting to think about the ways in which the media covered, and in some cases struggled to cover, this trial. So one of the New York Times' solutions was to set up a live blog, which is a minute-by-minute, essentially play-by-play of the trial, and to have me and some of my colleagues sending out moment-by-moment updates, almost as if we were broadcasters, but doing it all in text. And so I think for people who are really, really interested in the trial, who understood it at a fundamental level and really cared to know what was going on, I imagine that was really great for them. And I know we got a lot of great feedback on that. But I also think that it was difficult for people who maybe weren't quite as interested, who didn't know as much about what was going on, to dive in and really understand things. And so not having been recorded, this trial kind of taking place almost in seclusion. Yes, the media was there, but the public didn't have direct access to it. I think it forced us to make some really difficult choices.
I mean, the other thing about this trial is you talk about this being a New York story, but you have David Pecker on the stand. You have Michael Cohen on the stand. I mean, this does become, these are times, it seems to me in reading the book, where the circus goes from being outside to inside.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, because the trial is a referendum on that first campaign, which is a less professional campaign than the one we just saw him run, you see these figures from Trump's former life, you know, the tabloid publisher David Pecker, the fixer Michael Cohen, and they're describing in really intimate detail the slipshod way in which Trump ran this first campaign, trying to bury these stories, trying to make sure that he was promoted by friendly media outlets, that they were denigrating his opponents, and that most importantly, they were keeping out of the public these stories that could have been really damaging for him. So to have David Pecker and Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels and Hope Hicks, this remarkable cast of witnesses, was one of the things that I think made this trial so extraordinary to witness.
So as the trial wraps up and endless speculation as to what this would mean for Donald Trump and his political future, we now somewhat know the answer to that question, and I wonder how much that was forefront in your mind.
It was not actually forefront in my mind. I'm a legal reporter. What I do is I cover criminal cases, civil cases, trials, and I typically think of them as a legal reporter might. So in the case of a criminal trial, I'm very interested in the prosecutor's strategy, the defense strategy, how the two are competing to persuade the jury. And so one of the things I was less focused on during the reporting of this trial was how might this play out weeks and months down the line, in part because there was so much to cover in the here and now, and in part because it was a really unknowable answer. And it was very interesting to me, Joe, to hear that you called it one of the most consequential trials of the century. I absolutely agree, but I don't think it was consequential because there were obvious consequences for Donald Trump. I think it was consequential because it gave us this incredible picture of what the status of the rule of law is in this country and how politics and how our politics today in particular have really kind of gotten to a place where a criminal conviction doesn't necessarily matter to a majority of voters.
It's hard to believe even 10 years ago that a president could have been found guilty, or a former president, and then run again and win. I mean, it just that in and of itself just seems and I don't know, is that a Trump thing, or again, is that as you just articulated, the way it is now?
So I think that it is the way it is now to some extent. And one of the things that I try to do in this book is lay out the kind of media conditions that allowed Trump to gain an audience and to gain popularity and eventually to gain political power. And some of the things that I've been talking about, the way that he thrives in on television, the way that he thrives on social media, the way I think that people respond to the way he expresses his political ideas and the way he jokes around and the way he seems to people who support him to be really authentic. You know, his critics call him a liar all the time. And I think his supporters, some of them would probably grant that sometimes he's not telling the truth, but yet they feel as if they have an authentic sense of the man. I don't think Trump invented that atmosphere. I don't think he invented the cultural moment in which we live. I think he just excels in it. And I think one of the things that has happened during that moment is that these institutions that maintain the rule of law, our judges, our prosecutors, our courthouses, our media, has not kept up with this way of dispensing information, of explaining how they do what they do, and of seeming authentic to people. And so I think in many ways, Trump has the upper hand, and it's one of the reasons he's so powerful. And I think we're really seeing institutions struggle to respond to that now.
And what you have written about is something we'll probably not see again because all of the other criminal cases have been dismissed.
Yeah, that's 100% right. And not only that, a few weeks after this trial ended, the Supreme Court released the presidential immunity decision, which essentially says that Trump cannot be prosecuted for official acts he takes during office while in office. So that makes it just significantly harder to prosecute him. Furthermore, Trump has hired officials who really have his back in a way that officials during his first term didn't always. And so when you see these incidents that I think are making people question whether there should be investigation into the way cryptocurrency is being used, some of the moves at the Justice Department, SignalGate with a reporter getting added to this classified text or top secret text, I think that one of the reasons you're not seeing investigations get started is because of the way that Trump learned these levers of government and really transformed the institutions that might otherwise hold him accountable.
So you use the word consequences before, and here he is found guilty, and yet the political consequences were not as severe as they could have been. Do you speculate at all, or I just mean is in your interest of how this trial would have been different if cameras were in the courtroom?
Yeah, I think about this all the time. It's one of the great, interesting questions to me because I think my default answer, and of course this is all purely speculative,
sure,
is that not much would have changed necessarily. I think information can be kind of cut up and put online in a way that flatters whoever is presenting that information. But that being said, I have a slight thought that what I saw in that courtroom was so compelling, what I tried to describe in the book was so compelling that I do think that had people kind of had access to it and understood the case better and been able to see some of these remarkable moments, including seeing Trump completely out of character from the way they so often see him, that it might have made a difference in how people perceive the case and how people perceive Donald Trump and maybe even in the campaign.
The name of the book is Dragon on Center Street, New York versus Donald J. Trump. Jonah Bromwich, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Of course, it's a total privilege to be here. Thank you.
Very nice. Be well. Again, the name of the book is Dragon on Center Street. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.